This is our number two.
It's time for the fastest 15 minutes of the news. This is Dory's Fastest 15.
Oh, it's a world of news in a tidy little 15-minute package just for you. Welcome to our Fastest 15. Got quite a jam-packed. Nicole, how are we going to get all this in?
Maybe I know. We don't have a lot of time here today.
No.
Feels like a very short show, even though it's same as it always is.
I know because we just and you and I were saying this morning or yesterday, I guess, after the show, we couldn't believe it was Thursday already, because there's some weeks where it's a little more challenging than others. This week has flown by because there's been so much news, so many stories that our listeners have given us as exclusives, and on and on and on. Is John Curley joining us in the 2 o'clock hour today?
That's the plan.
Wow. Okay, see, now that's even more stuff we got to jam in here. Okay, let's get to work here. I want to start by giving congratulations. Jay Inslee, he presents, you know, and I'm not a big fan of his politics, but he presents, it's called the 2022 Governor's Arts and Heritage Awards. And it says on the website, ArtsWA is a government site. ArtsWA is thrilled to announce the 2022 Governor's Arts and Heritage Awards. And, you know, even though I'm not a big fan of the governor, I like the arts. My wife and I enjoy live theater. I enjoy music. I like the arts. And so the people who are being honored by Jay Inslee, even if I don't always agree with Inslee, I would also like to pay honor to these Arts Award winners. And so, for 2022, Governor Jay Inslee's Arts Award for Advocacy goes to Dow Constantine! Yeah! Nicole?
Yes.
Is there anybody in the world of arts advocacy besides Dow Constantine who might have been more deserving of this honor?
I'm guessing there's some people that devote their lives to it.
I would think so, too. Huh. It's almost like the politicians just kiss each other's butts.
It is almost like that.
Well, there's another phrase for it, but it's a little cruder. But it involves a round shape. Anyway, that's all I'm going to stop. Don't worry about me. I'm not crossing any lines. Mm-hmm. So anyway, but yes, so the entire Dory Monson Show staff would like to congratulate Dow Constantine for winning the 2022 Governor's Arts Advocacy Award. And when I say the entire Dory Monson Show staff, Nicole, would you also congratulate Dow Constantine for us?
Probably not.
Come on. Andrew, would you congratulate Dow Constantine from our show staff, please?
He's not paying attention.
Well, how is Dow going to get his proper props?
That seems to be
a less than enthusiastic response to this absolute glowing honor that Dow Constantine has worked so hard in the arts community to win. Remember, what was the show? Was it Frozen? What was that show with the Paramount? Where
you sat next to him?
I had gotten tickets for all my daughters.
Yeah, I think it was
and my
Frozen.
Wife. I think it was Frozen, about 3 years ago, and I start leading my family into the row because we had 5 seats, and as I'm walking down the row, my wife grabs my shirt and she pulls me back to the other side of her while we're in between, you know, in the row. And what are you doing? You'll thank me in a minute. And then my wife takes the seat next to Dow Constantine instead of me. That I can't even imagine. That would have been so awkward.
I know. I appreciate your wife for doing that. However, it would have been much more fun to have you sit next to him. And maybe we would be talking to him occasionally. Maybe you would have made friends. You know, you can disagree politically, but you could have gone out and had a drink on him.
I would have been on him. Yeah, I could have had his sheriff's deputy driver take us.
Get your free ride home.
Yeah. But anyway, so again, congratulations, Dow Constantine, the 2022 Jay Inslee Governor's Arts Advocacy Award winner. Just, man, so proud to live in his county and the other guy's state. All right, next up in the Fastest 15, there was a shooting near I-5 this morning. How long are we going to keep putting up with this? So there was absolute gridlock this morning because in a homeless encampment right adjacent to the express lanes on I-5, there was a shooting, two guys, one 55-year-old guy, one 64-year-old, both of them shot. All of a sudden, about 6:30 a.m., calls come in to 911. We just saw a shooting in the homeless encampment. A man's down. And, you know, police respond. They have shut down all but one lane of the express lanes, which just led to gridlock. People had a nightmare commute this morning. And it's because they allow these homeless encampments, you know, they just finally found the guy who was throwing rocks on State Route 900 for months and months and months. You've got the people who are dumping stuff on I-5 from the homeless encampment down near the I-90 interchange. You got a homeless encampment alongside the express lanes, and people are going to get killed. And it's also just, I mean, it's a nightmare issue. If anybody has driven, if you're going southbound on I-5, have you taken the Northgate exit at all, Nicole, lately from southbound I-5?
You know what? I haven't taken. I drive by it every day, but I haven't taken the exit recently.
You can't really see it unless you take the exit. I took that exit. I went into Ballard to go bike riding with my daughter a couple nights ago. It looks like Calcutta, India. I mean, it is just absolute packed with tarps and tents and garbage everywhere. And that's where there was the shooting at the mini mart just a block away a few months ago. And it's like all our politicians are willing to put up with the death and the destruction and the damage and the commute times lengthened by hours. They're all willing to put up with it because nobody will say what needs to be said. And that is, public camping will not be tolerated. Two choices: treatment, jail, or get out. Three choices: get out of the region, go to jail, or we'll offer you treatment. Those are your three choices. Instead, they just put up with this nonsense every single day, and it is ridiculous. All right, up next in the Fest 15, Trevor Noah has announced that he is leaving The Daily Show after 7 years. He made the announcement last night. But have you watched The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, Nicole?
No, I haven't seen it since John left.
Yeah. Okay, here's what he said last night.
Honestly, I've loved hosting this show. It's been one of my greatest challenges. It's been one of my greatest joys. I've loved trying to figure out how to make people laugh, even when laughed together, we've cried together.
Dump out of that there. So he said that it was just his time to go. Well, I doubt if this was his choice, because the ratings for The Daily Show were just absolutely in the toilet. They had less than one third the number of viewers that the show had when Jon Stewart was hosting it. Now, I'm going to say, I can't stand Jon Stewart's politics, but I really enjoyed The Daily Show when he was hosting it because it was well produced. It was smart. When he was making fun of something, he had a good foundation. It wasn't like the idiocy of Jimmy Kimmel and Stephen Colbert and even Jimmy Fallon, who's decided he's going to go somewhat political. And all of a sudden, they lose two-thirds of their audience because it's a horrible show. It's not funny, and it's horribly produced, and it's not smart. Under Jon Stewart, it was smart, it was brilliantly produced, and even when he was making fun of stuff that I didn't like being made fun of, it was funny. And that's pretty rare. And Jon Stewart has gone even deeper off the deep end since he left the show politically. But now that's why they're bailing on him. And by the way, the number one show in late night, it's television history. It's Greg Gutfeld's show on Fox News. It's first time in history a cable show has defeated The Tonight Show and Late Night on CBS and Get Jimmy Kimmel Live. He beats all of them. He crushed Trevor Noah. And that's because even though the woke executives at all of these networks keep pushing their politics instead of entertainment on America, America finally is saying, we reject you. It's kind of like this show where we just try to do a really good show, and you might disagree with my ideas. You might disagree with my ideology. But people have responded to the show in greater numbers than ever. And I really appreciate that because we do work hard on it. But Cairo stuck with me for many years when there was a very loud contingent trying to cancel. And the audience finds what it wants to find. And the executives at these networks, they fail to try to give the audience what the audience desires. They would rather just try to change the audience's mind on everything. All right, up next in the Festus 15. So Russell Wilson, I see this is one of the top trending stories in the country. Russell Wilson recorded a TikTok Subway ad. And I will say this is Russell Wilson in a nutshell. And everybody's making fun of it, and understandably so and rightly so. But this, if you wanted to just explain to somebody who's never heard of Russell Wilson, if you want to explain to somebody everything that Russell Wilson is, all you would have to do is play the Subway TikTok ad for them.
Hey, you want to split this Subway sandwich? It is my signature sandwich. It's called the Danger Witch, and it's dangerously good.
Be careful, though. It's spicy.
Then he's eating the
sandwich. You ever done anything dangerous?
Come on, talk.
Spicy. That is dangerous.
It is dangerous.
I've done something like that, too.
Spicy. The thing about Russell Wilson, he's a fabulously successful man, both as football player and certainly is a money maker off the field. But Russell Wilson might be one of the least self-aware human beings that you'll ever know. And, you know, I've talked with him a few times, and he's always a nice enough guy, but you never feel like you're talking to a real person with him. It's always an act. He's always playing a role, playing a character. I've worked with people like that. It's really kind of, many years ago, I worked with somebody, and they would always come, a very nice person, but they would always do voices whenever they would have anything to say. They'd say it in somebody else's voice to try to make you laugh, and it was never funny. And then you're in this uncomfortable position of, should I give them the courtesy laugh? Or should I just say, get to the point? And Russell Wilson has always struck me like that. It's just, he's always playing a character. And that's why everybody's mocking this, this Subway TikTok. And then finally in the Fast 15, you know, the NFL as a business is fabulously successful. And their ratings are through the roof the first 3 weeks. You know, a lot of people said a couple years ago, the NFL has gone so woke, and I'm through with them, with the kneeling and the decals and the end zone statements and all of that. Well, here's another example of where I just, and I enjoy football, but I can't stand the way the NFL has gone so woke. So this weekend and next, the National Football League is going to have players wear decals on their helmets representing heritage. Arizona Cardinals quarterback Kyler Murray is going to wear a South Korean flag. Dozens of players are going to wear the Nigerian flag. Some are going to wear Samoa, Germany, Cuba. Just a crazy thought. What about the United States flag as everyone's heritage? Why is there, I mean, this is the movement from the left to try to divide everybody, to hyphenate everybody, to make sure that we're just these groups of warring tribalism instead of all being Americans. And it's just sickening that it's because once divided, easier to conquer, right? So that's what the woke left is all about. So you're going to get all of these flag decals of other countries when our shared heritage of almost every NFL player and every NFL fan is America. But that's not politically correct because the U.S. flag represents tyranny or whatever nonsense they want to throw out at us. And that is your Fastest 15.
This has been the Fastest 15 Minutes in the News. Fast Dory's Fastest 15.
You give us 15 minutes, we'll give you the world. Hampshire looks forward to this. Actor Richard Thomas, a guy I've been watching since I was 10 years old. He's gonna be at the Paramount, but all the TV shows he's done. He joins us for the next half hour here on the Dory Monson Show. Well, one of the all-time classics of American theater is coming to our beautiful Paramount Theater here. To Kill a Mockingbird is going to run at the Paramount from October 11th to the 16th. And the star of the show is one of my favorites. I can't believe I haven't had him on the show before now. Richard Thomas joins us here on the Dory Monson Show. Richard, it's great to have you on. I appreciate this.
Thank you. It's great to be with you. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, you know, I was thinking as I was preparing for this interview, Richard, that I don't watch a lot of TV. But if I was to make a list of my favorite shows, The Waltons, The Americans, Ozark, and Match Game 73.
I think we should put Match Game 73 at the top of the list.
Who would all be on my list? I actually watched an episode with you last night with a bow tie and a plaid jacket. You looked very dapper.
Oh, my God, that jacket. I mean, you know, it was the 70s, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I want to talk about To Kill a Mockingbird. Over the years, I've heard you talk many times. You don't seem to mind talking about not your first role, but the role that made you famous on The Waltons.
Right.
You don't mind talking about that a little bit, do you?
No, not at all.
And I'll tell you a real quick story, and then I want to hear what you have to say. When I was about 10 years old, I didn't have a dad. My siblings were a lot older. Every Thursday night, my mom would have choir practice, and she'd drop me off at my aunt Sissy's, and we would sit with TV trays and watch The Waltons. And I loved it so much, Richard, because I never had a family dining table, and I didn't have siblings I ate with. And it was those eating scenes that just drew this 10-year-old kid in, man.
Wow. You know, these are the stories that I most love to hear. I people come up and say, you know, I used to watch with my grandma, my grandpa, and I have memories of them. We watched together, or you know, it used to be I loved you on The Waltons, and it was my mom loves you on The Waltons, and now it's like, oh, my grandma really loves you on The Waltons.
Right, right.
but I love these. I love the stories, the family stories, the connection. They mean the most to me. And the eating scenes, you know, around the dining table, they were really very special. Because we became such a family over the years, every time we would sit around that table together, it was really like a big family dinner. And they were at, I think those scenes were kind of at the heart of the show.
Well, and I've heard you talk in the past that you sat between the beautiful little 7-year-old actress who played your little sister and Will Gere, who's just a force of nature, and that you really had to work on your acting chops when you're sandwiched with those two.
I know. Look, the best thing to do is just lay low.
Minimalist,
but just to be as quiet as possible, which was not easy for me because I'm a maximalist actor by nature. But right. Yeah, it was the most wonderful experience. We really did forge a family connection, and we still are, all of us who are still here, stay in touch and all that. It's very, very, very heartening.
When you play one of the most iconic roles in TV history, and I've talked to a couple of your 70s TV peers, Henry Winkler and Alan Alda, about how they broke away from this role that they feared they would always be identified with and kind of get typecast in. Can you tell me a little bit about the thought process and then the actual process when you were transitioning from that to just an incredibly busy working actor?
Well, you know, at first you're like, okay, I'm out of here and I want everybody to be out of here with me. You know, and that's an unrealistic expectation to place on an audience, because the audience is going to love you and remember you for the thing that made you the most successful. That's just a fact of show business life. You know, if you're lucky enough, like me and Alan and Henry, you know, to find a role with which the entire country and the world at that time, because remember there were three networks and it was all over the world, right?
Oh, yeah.
So it wasn't just the United States. If you were lucky enough to land a part where you were going to have that kind of identification, the price you pay is that people will, and they should, remember you for that. So all you have to do is just go about the business of investing in time, you know, try not to do too many parts that are the same. If things come along that are very different, that's fun, but just do your work, you know, and let the years add up. Because I figured if I did 5 on the Waltons, it was going to take me 10 to sort of build a resume hefty enough to go be. I mean, I've been acting for a long time before I got the Waltons. I mean, I made my Broadway debut in 1958. So I was already an actor who'd been working for my age a long time.
Yeah.
But you know, you just have to play the long game with it, I think. And eventually things, you know, kind of even out and people remain, you know, you do other work and people appreciate it. But there's always going to be a special connection with that first big success, always. And it's unrealistic to expect that will ever go away. And it's a blessing indeed.
And then, I mean, you know, I look at your IMDb and there's no gap there. I mean, you have worked continuously since then, haven't you?
Yes. Yeah. There's, I mean, you know, maybe there's a 6-month period somewhere where you go, oh my God, what's happening to my career?
Right.
But it never lasts. So yeah, I've been really, really lucky. I've just worked and worked and worked and I love it. And it's the only thing I know how to do. So it's a good thing.
Yeah. Well, you used two words there. You said, I've been lucky and I just worked and worked. I think it's been the work more than the luck. I mean, don't you create your own luck?
Well, luck is a complicated word and a complicated thing. And we say it because things come to us that seem like blessings and we're grateful for them. And that feels like luck. But of course, it's all intertwined. One thing happens because of another. But, you know, opportunities come to your way or they don't. And when they do, if you are able to grab hold of them and make the best of them, then it results in something good. You know?
Well, you're going to take me down a little tangent now with what you just said. Opportunities come along. Are there opportunities that came along that you said no to, that you regretted?
Well, you know, nothing that would be of note, except that, yeah, there would be like TV movies or something, or options that would come along. It would be like, well, you know, that's a little too familiar. I've played this just too many times and I don't need to do that again. But surprisingly, not that many. If a script is, I mean, one goes to work for many different reasons, you know, in our business. Sometimes it's like the perfect part, the perfect script or the people you want to work with. And sometimes it's the next job and that's going to be what it's going to be. And you're going to do it because you need to keep working because it's your career. And it's how you support yourself. And so there are all kinds of reasons why you take different jobs over the course of a long career.
And were there any you pursued? I mean, not that you were offered and turned down. Were there some you pursued and didn't get?
The only part I pursued and didn't get was a miniseries many years ago, I think in the 70s. And the funny thing about it is I can't even remember the name of it right now.
Okay. Well,
it was based on a book. It may come to me in the course of our conversation. And I went for it. I mean, we auditioned. People will do an audition for something they really want that may or may not be a lead pipe cinch for. But I think the perfect example of that is Brando testing for The Godfather.
Yeah.
You always have to be prepared to go after something you want, and you can't be too proud. You got to always be ready to just say, put your hand up in the air and say, what about me? Consider me. You know, that's important.
As I said, you have a million things in the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s, the 2000s. Then 2011, The Americans come, or 2013, The Americans comes along.
Yeah. Right.
Man, I tell you, man, my wife and I were and are so hooked on that show. And
that's a good show.
What a great show. What makes, because we're so fragmented. You were talking about there were only three networks during the Waltons. Now there are a million networks. We're so fragmented.
I know.
What does it take for a show like The Americans or The Ozark to break out?
Well, that's a mystery. And again, it is a combination of so many causes and conditions that it's hard to break it down into one thing. I would have to say that it needs to stand alone. It needs to be a show that is an idea, a new idea, something that we haven't really seen before or that we haven't seen in that form.
Yeah.
So like the Waltons, right? You know, we had all those sitcoms and we had the variety shows and we had the cop show. We had all that stuff. You know, the country was torn apart by Vietnam and Watergate and the political situation. It was a very divided country at the time. And then this show comes along, which is just about a family, a poor family trying to make it in the Depression. And it was the only place you could go to look at that, you know, and so people slowly found it, and by the end of the first season, it was a number one position, because it was a new idea. And the Americans, when I, you know, my friend Joel Fields, who was one of the creators, called me, and he said, "Look, we're doing a show, and this is what it's about." I said, "Well, that's a great idea."
Yeah.
And he said, "You know, we want the FBI chief to be sort of, we don't want it to be we don't want to cast it in the usual way. We'd like to have a different flavor, a different kind of persona. So would you be interested?" And I thought, well, this is certainly a counterintuitive casting, you know, for me, which is a great reason to do a job.
Sure.
If it's good. And I know that I knew that Joel and Joe Weisberg would really do a good show. And then I read the scripts. It was like, well, this is fantastic, you know, because it was a very different, new, original idea. I think their new show is I haven't seen it, but a very new idea.
Yeah.
And so things stand. And Ozark, is just so outrageously dark and crazy. I mean,
fantastic.
The creation of a crime family. You know, the story of how a crime family is created. Absolutely fascinating. I mean, you also have to really have really good writing. You have to have producers with a vision. You have to have good writing, and you have to cast it well. And and obviously the directors. So it's just a combination of so many things. Well, but originality is a big deal.
But it's just crazy, and it says so much about you. 50 years ago, you're in the number one show in the country, and 50 years after that, you are in the most talked about show in the country in Ozark. That's that's not a bad pair of bookends there, Richard.
Well, I hadn't thought of it, but thank you. You've made my day.
Okay, good. That's what I try to do. All right, hold on, Richard. We're going to spend the rest of the half hour with Richard Thomas. He's going to be at the Paramount in To Kill a Mockingbird, October 11th through the 16th. Tickets available at seattle.broadway.com. And we'll continue our conversation in just a moment here on the Dory Monson Show. We are back with Richard Thomas. What a career this man has had. He's going to be playing Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird, October 11th through the 16th at the Paramount Theater. All right, Richard, tell me about To Kill a Mockingbird. You're doing the show right now and talking to me from San Francisco, right?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. We're in San Francisco, and then we're going to come to you as soon as we're done in San Francisco. Okay. We talked a lot about the TV and about films, you know, and all that.
Yeah.
And now we're going to talk about, you know, my first love as an actor, which is the theater, which I've been doing since I was a child and which I've always continued to do, and which brings me so much deep pleasure and which I think is such a great form. And so, you know, I've been very lucky in the theater as well. You know, I've done like 14 Broadway shows. I've got my Tony nomination a few years ago, and, you know, it's been a wonderful career for me in theater. And this show, To Kill a Mockingbird, when I knew that they were going to be doing this, Jeff and Aaron Sorkin and Bart Scheer were going to put this show on, I thought, well, you know what, if this show tours, because I happen to love touring, if this show tours, I want to do it. And I got the invitation, and I was thrilled. It's just a fantastic adaptation. It's a good part for me, I think. It's just a wonderful company, and it's been a great, great experience. You know, it's, of course, you know, we know that it's one of the most, I guess, as of the last poll, the New York Times, the most respected piece of American literature. Americans love it more than any other book. We had a great movie with Greg Peck all those years back, and now Aaron Sorkin has brought it not forward in time. He's kept it true to its time and place, but in an adaptation that speaks brilliantly to the way we are looking at the world today and the issues that are raised in the source material. So it's really a privilege to be doing it.
Yeah.
And he's written a great role for the Atticus actor. It's just a fantastic role. And
yeah.
I've done a lot of big roles in the theater over my life, and this is one of them that is deeply satisfying. I'm just having a great time.
I can't wait to see it. And it says a lot, and Aaron Sorkin has earned this confidence, but to take on Harper Lee and to write an adaptation, that's pretty gutsy stuff there.
It is, and you'll see. I mean, if you come and see it, you'll see where he is kept very, very, very true to the source material, but introduced newer perspectives on the issues that seem to be in line with how we're talking about them now. I mean, without it making it contemporary, without making it anachronistic at all. He's also put a great deal of humor into it. It's, you know, he writes very funny. He writes great comedy as well as you know, drama. So he's mixed it beautifully, the light and the dark. And we have just a wonderful, wonderful company. And also, I'm so excited to be back in Seattle. You know, I did many, many years ago at the Moore Theater. I mean, many years ago, because it was one of the first shows that HBO did when HBO was new. I did a production of Barefoot in the Park, which was your best art.
Really?
Show I did.
At the Moore?
We did
wow.
it in Seattle. Yep. And this was like, well, the Waltons was either going on or had just finished, or I had just left it. But then I was there with 12 Angry Men. I was there with The Humans a few years back. At Seattle Rep, and now I'm back again, and I just can't wait to get to Seattle.
Yeah, well, we're looking forward to it very much. All right, before we close, let's play the big money match game. Easter, this is from your show from 1973. Easter blank.
Bunny.
You still got it. Ding, ding, ding. It's really great talking with you, Richard, and look forward to seeing the
show.
Thank
you so much. Well, I had a blast, and I really appreciate your invitation. Thanks a lot. You have a great day.
You got it. All right, Richard Thomas. To Kill a Mockingbird, Paramount Theater, October 11th through 16th. Tickets on sale now. All right, love to hear your thoughts on all this. You can text me, 888-973-CHIRO, 888-973-5476. We'll check the news, and then lots more to come here on the Dory Monson Show.